If you're in your car while you're listening to this, be careful. Don't listen too closely because I want you to be safe on the road and I don't want you to get a ticket. But if you do get a ticket or if you're charged with a more serious offense, you can take comfort in the fact that you have access to public defenders. You have a right to have a defense lawyer in a criminal case, a right guaranteed by the Sixth Amendment of the United States Constitution. But what happens if you have a serious non-criminal legal problem? Do you still have a right to a lawyer? Well, in one sense, yes. But what happens if you can't afford one? Do you really have access to justice? Tony Seaton, a lawyer in Johnson City, Tennessee, is very concerned about that, and he's going to tell us all about it today. I'm Stuart Harris. It's your weekly constitutional, and our subject is access to justice.
Your weekly constitutional is produced at WETS-FM in cooperation with the home of the Constitution, James Madison's Montpelier. Your host is Stuart Harris, who teaches constitutional law at the Appalachian School of Law in Grundy, Virginia.
One of the nicest things about doing this weekly radio show is hearing from listeners, people like you who listen in and who comment on the subjects that we discuss and who have suggestions for new shows and who send me emails. Oh, by the way, my email address is sharris@asl.edu, or if you prefer, ywc@montpelier.org, where you'll get my scheduler. But however you do it, however you contact me, I appreciate it. And I particularly appreciate it when I hear from colleagues in the legal profession. The show's not specifically directed at lawyers, but lots of lawyers listen. And on several occasions, they've called me up or emailed me or critiqued something I've said and given me different insights. And among those lawyers is a fellow by the name of Tony Seaton, who actually practices law right here in Johnson City, Tennessee, where WETS is located. And Tony and I have emailed and talked back and forth a few times. And in fact, he's invited me to come speak to his legal organization, the Tennessee Association for Justice, where I've done classes on ethics, and they've even paid me money for that. That's been very nice. And after the most recent time that I did a CLE course, a continuing legal education course for the Tennessee Association for Justice, Tony and I sat down and he bought me a couple of drinks, and we got to talking about the stuff he does outside of his day job. And it turns out that Tony is very, very concerned about access to justice, about the question of whether people really can get proper legal representation, whether they really can assert their legal rights and really have their day in court when they can't afford lawyers. It's a huge problem, not just in Johnson City, not just in Tennessee, but all over the country. But unlike many lawyers, Tony's actually done something about it. In fact, he's done quite a lot about it. And after I spoke with him for a few minutes, I said, Tony, you got to come on the show, and we got to talk about this. And here he is. So, Tony Seaton, who are you and what do you do?
Well, I am a sixth-generation Upper East Tennessean. And I've...
Sixth generation. You can trace it back that far.
To the 1720s.
Who was the first Seaton?
The first Seaton was James Seaton out of Virginia.
Remarkable. And, well, that's really cool. Okay. And we haven't even gotten to what you do.
Right. I am a lawyer. I've been practicing law in Johnson City for 33 years now.
My goodness. You are getting old.
I am old.
So am I. We're all old people here today. Tremendous. And you and I know each other because I also have in the past at least practiced some law, and you've been kind enough to invite me down to do some CLE, some continuing legal education programs for the Tennessee Association of Justice, right?
Correct. Yeah. Each year we do an annual review seminar where we teach lawyers different areas of practice, and you have been so gracious to come down and help us with the ethics part, and we appreciated that.
And you've been so gracious as to pay me for doing so. So it's been a very gracious experience from my perspective. But you also, of course, have a law practice here. What sort of law do you specialize in?
Well, we primarily do personal injury, Social Security, and workers' compensation. That's about all that we do.
Mm-hmm. And today you're here because you're also very active in what we might call generally access to justice programs, right?
Correct.
Okay, what's that all about? Tell us about it.
Well, the Access to Justice program actually was started by the Tennessee Supreme Court back in 2008, where they had pretty much decided that a lot of the folks aren't getting the legal help that they need. Everyone's familiar with legal aid. There's legal aid of up recency. There's legal aid pretty much in all the states in the country. But they're constantly being defunded. They're constantly getting larger and larger caseloads. And so there needed to be some sort of a system whereby we could allow people that did not have the money or who could not hire a lawyer the same things that people that do have money need with a courthouse. You know, basically what we've set up with our civil system is a system whereby people can go in and resolve their problems without resorting to the duels or the guns and things like that. And the more that we
do duels, no guns. Good,
right.
Good idea.
Right.
But before we get to the details, Sonny, I want to interrupt you here and just talk about the need, first of all. It's always occurred to me that the need for legal services is very similar to the need for health care. It's a really essential need, and most people will have it from time to time. I mean, you don't get sick every day, but when you're sick, you really need health care. And in much the same fashion, you don't always have an immediate, urgent legal need, but when you do, sometimes it can be urgent. And if you're really, really poor, you might qualify for legal aid, assuming there's funding, just kind of like you might qualify for Medicaid or something of that sort. Or if you're really well off, you can afford a doctor or you can afford to buy a lawyer. But there are all kinds of people in the middle, and especially toward the low end of the middle, that just have very urgent legal needs, and they've got no place to turn. I mean, there's an enormous need out there, isn't there?
Right. Yeah. You know, early on, especially in the civil realm, you know, we want to distinguish between the civil and the criminal, because in the criminal realm, they have started legal or public defenders.
Right. You've actually got a constitutional right, and the state more or less has to fund some kind of public defender for people who are charged with crimes.
Correct. Both the state and the federal government.
Right.
Do that. But in the civil area, we were missing that. We mm-hmm. were, you know, there was a big pocket there. And so we couldn't figure out, you know, what it was that we needed to do to help them. You know, to a large extent, the contingency fee allows people access to lawyers that they couldn't otherwise pay. So in other words, if someone has an issue whereby that there could be a monetary recovery, a lawyer would take a percentage fee, and then the lawyer would finance that litigation. So that's worked very well, but it doesn't work for the smaller things. It doesn't work for divorces, because there's no contingent. There's no recovery you're going to get in a divorce. There's no recovery if you're going to have a small property dispute, or if you're being evicted from your home or something to that effect. And so that was kind of the whole concept of coming up with legal services.
Before we go
sure.
there, I mm-hmm. keep interrupting you,
sure,
Tony,
so
and
fine,
I apologize.
Fine.
But I want to really emphasize that sometimes lawyers, especially lawyers like you who do personal injury work, are the subject of criticism, because there'll be some big newspaper story about a $10 million judgment, and then someone say, oh, well, of course, the lawyer took all the money. Well, A, he didn't. That's an exaggeration. B, even if he did take a significant proportion of any final judgment in the case or any settlement in the case, that's A, to cover his expenses. I'm using too many A's and B's here, but that cover his expenses, which he's probably fronted. And secondly, to compensate him for that case and to some extent for all the cases he took that didn't end up with a settlement or a judgment. And as you point out, this is not, it goes beyond just compensating the lawyer adequately. If it weren't for the contingent fee arrangement, many people who don't have a lot of money and who are injured could never get access to lawyers because they would have no way to pay them. So PI lawyers who operate in a contingent fee basis are themselves already offering access to justice for many people.
Absolutely, and that's very well put.
Okay, thank you very much. Mm-hmm. I appreciate that. I didn't do a lot of PI work myself back when I practiced law, but I took a few contingent fee cases. And believe me, those were people who didn't have any way to pay. And the only hope that any of us had that there would be some way for them to get a recovery and for me as their lawyer to get paid is if I took the case, I fronted the expenses, we took the risk that we wouldn't get anything. And then at the end of that rainbow, if we happen to get a recovery, then there could be some sort of compensation for both the client and for the lawyer. That's not something to be criticized.
No, I don't think so either. And, you know, as a matter of fact, you know, the contingency fee works pretty well. And it works not just for personal injury. It works for all kinds of cases. You know, if you're going to have a recovery,
right.
You know, whether it's a class action or whether it's a wrongful termination or whether it's, you know, sexual discrimination or civil rights or whatever, it works fairly well. But recently I had my own experience where I had a banking problem, in my own office, and I needed a lawyer to helped me resolve a dispute with the bank, and I ended up having to hire a lawyer out of Nashville. It was $500 an hour. It took my breath. That takes anybody's breath. Mm-hmm. I mean, $150 an hour where you're handing somebody a blank check and saying, you know, you just send me a bill every month and I'll pay it, takes anybody's breath. I don't care what stage of life you're in.
Right. It does. And if you can negotiate a deal instead where you say, you only get paid, lawyer, if I win, or if you win for me, lawyer, then that means that the client can get, in some cases, some representation. It also means that a personal injury lawyer, such as yourself, or like I did occasionally, tends to screen out the frivolous cases and the cases that don't have a chance for any sort of significant recovery. And so, by and large, only cases that do have arguable merits are going to make their way into the court system under that system.
Right. That's exactly right. Because, you know, if, you know, like you say, you get paid well on a good case, but you don't factor in the other 25 people that you've helped, you know, that didn't have a case, that you've had to counsel with them. And, you know, whether we're doing clinics or whether we're doing it in my office, you know, when people call in, I've got to talk with them and I've got to deal with them. And sometimes it's just a counseling thing. It's not a thing that I'm going to make a dollar off of.
Right.
You know, one of the things that the legislature has done recently is they have shifted workers' compensation. People that get hurt at work, they've shifted those kinds of cases from the court system into an administrative system whereby the executive branch of the government appoints a person to hear those kinds of cases. And they've probably cut down 60 to 70% on the amount that they're going to recover. They're not going to be able to hire lawyers. And we spend an inordinate amount of time working on those issues, you know, working on getting somebody to the doctor, getting them to therapy or whatever, and that's just no longer going to exist. And that's in essence the government taking away people's access to justice.
It is, and that's very, very important. And I'm so glad we had a chance to talk about that, because the traditional legal system, and especially the contingent fee system, has worked very well for a long, long time, as long as reasonable recoveries were possible. And when you start limiting the recoveries that potential plaintiffs can have, you are limiting their access to justice. And so a lot of this so-called tort reform really has the effect of hurting poor people, the people who can't otherwise find counsel to represent them. And I know from personal experience, I once worked on a case, I'm thinking it was either 3 or 4 years, and we ended up losing. Nobody ever paid me a dime for any of the time I spent on that. So why was I willing to take that case? Well, for a variety of reasons. I believed in the case, I believed in the client, but I also thought it was possible that I'd be compensated for it. But I took the risk and I lost. I'm sure that you've got that same story, right?
Yeah, you're preaching to the choir.
Exactly. You know all about
sure.
that. And so those big cases that occasionally you'll get, and fortunately I'm sure you have and I have too, had some good, great successes. Well, it's not just that one case. You're now, to some extent, making up for all those other risks you took where things didn't pay off.
Right. And, you know, and seasoned lawyers understand that. I mean,
right.
Seasoned lawyers know that you're not going to take a frivolous case to try to settle it because, you know, a good defense lawyer on the other side is going to hammer me. He's going to take me to the cleaners. He's going to take depositions. It's just not going to be worth it.
And the judge is going to hammer you.
Right.
And you can end up on the wrong side of a malpractice claim or a bar complaint if you take frivolous cases.
Exactly. And so, I mean, you know, we get to the point now, and what I try to do when I teach or counsel with other lawyers is I say, if somebody doesn't have a case, don't take the easy way out and say, I've got a conflict of interest. Tell them why their case has issues and tell them this is probably not something you want to pursue in a court system.
And that's a hard conversation to have because somebody comes into your office and this person's clearly been injured. This person's clearly upset. In fact, the day that you go into a lawyer's office as a client is probably for most people not among their favorite days.
Right.
And then you have to sit there and listen to them. And all of a sudden it just clicks in your mind, this person's not going to win. you know, this person may have suffered a terrible injury and it might be morally outrageous what's going on, but for whatever reason, I can't take this case because it's simply not going to work out for this client. And you have to sit there and look at the client or the potential client and say, I'm very sorry, but you don't have a case.
Right. You know, I think that our first job as a lawyer is a counselor. You know, you've got to sit down, you've got to listen to people, you've got to be empathetic, you've got to understand their circumstances, and then you've got to apply your experience as to whether or not you can help them. And if you can help them, you tell them you can help them. And if you can't, you tell them that too. That's the best thing you can do.
It is, but it's hard therapy. It's Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking with Johnson City, Tennessee lawyer Tony Seaton about access to justice. After the break, we'll have our Madison Minute, and then we'll come back and speak some more with Tony Seaton. Stick around.
In the last few days of the 1787 Constitutional Convention, a majority of delegates, including James Madison, rejected a proposal for a Bill of Rights. Madison was confident that the Constitution didn't give the federal government any powers that could endanger individual liberties. Madison thought it was potentially dangerous to list some of the rights of the people in case they might be interpreted as the only rights of the people. During the ratification debates, however, Madison realized that many people were unwilling to approve the Constitution unless a Bill of Rights was added. He successfully ran for Congress by pledging to support such a bill and began advocating for it within 4 days of George Washington's inauguration. Madison was aware that some members of Congress were still dissatisfied with the new Constitution. Madison's concern, however, was that the rights of the people be protected from actions of the states as well as the federal government. With a Madison Minute, I'm Jim Blaylock.
It's your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking with Tony Seaton about access to justice. Before the break, we were talking about something that's often overlooked. The traditional contingent fee arrangement is actually one method by which poor people can gain access to legal representation. Much maligned, but it's one of my causes. I think it's unfairly maligned. Now, let me just interject here. I'm not defending unethical behavior. I'm not defending every lawyer who's ever been out there who might have done something objectionable. And I'm sure that you can find some anecdotal case, some place where someone's done something wrong and some plaintiff's attorney has acted like the proverbial ambulance chaser. Sure. Every profession has bad apples.
Absolutely. You know, there's bad lawyers, there's bad doctors, there's bad insurance agents. There's, you know, every profession has their problems.
Correct? Right. But you can't take the individual bad circumstance and generalize that into a critique of an entire system that traditionally has worked very, very well.
Right. You know, the thing that I like about our system is that almost every lawyer that I know and deal with is honest. They are straightforward. The judges, we have one of the best judicial benches in probably in the country, in my opinion. They're straightforward, and you know when you're that way, then you get people's things resolved. You get their issues resolved. You know, throughout the 33 years that I've been in practice, I've had occasion where somebody will come in and they'll say, "Hey, you know, I've had this injury, but it's really not that bad. But I can make it as bad as you want me to make it, or I can go see whatever doctor." And, you know, a lot of times people think that that's what lawyers do. No, that is not what we do. We take legitimate claims for legitimate people, and we look at those people and we say, you know what, the court system is not where you need to be. I mean, if you're going to, you know, we're there to find the truth, and we're there to get a good result.
Right. And if occasionally those things happen, then they should be punished. And if occasionally
right.
lawyers bring frivolous lawsuits, they should be sanctioned.
No question.
But, okay. I'm going to get off my hobby horse here. It's an important access issue. But you're here to talk about not the traditional contingent fee cases. You're here to talk about circumstances where that's not available because, as you said, there's not really an opportunity for or an expectation of a big monetary recovery, and yet people still have legal needs, and they're not being addressed. So how are you and your colleagues helping with that?
Well, let me give you a little bit of the history, because when I very first started practicing law in Washington County, the General Sessions courts, which are the small claims types of courts, would have a need for lawyers. And so we came up with a system. We called it queen for a day, for lack of a better word, where a lawyer would volunteer, go into court one day and just represent everybody that was there. This is...
Oh, good heavens.
Yeah, this is...
That's scary.
This is back in the early 1980s.
Right.
And, you know, because we didn't have legal services and we didn't have public defenders back then. And so we would just, you know, I would be sitting there and I would probably do, you know, a half a dozen DUIs. I'd do, you know, a couple civil cases and, you know, I end up... By the end of the day, I'd represent 16, you know, different folks. And so, you know, and it was so rewarding. It was so gratifying. And you get people that just would hug your neck and they'd say, thank you so much. I know you're doing this as a volunteer. And so, you know, that kind of sunk in with me throughout the time. And, you know, as my practice got to be more specialized and I became more, you know, doing a lot more of the administrative type of work, I missed it. And then, lo and behold, about 5 years ago, legal services came up with this idea of doing free legal advice clinics. They did it one time at the legal aid office, and we invited a bunch of lawyers. I think we probably had 8 lawyers that came, and we saw maybe 30 or 40 clients that day. And it was kind of the same thing, and I felt like I'm getting back to my roots of what I used to do to, you know, to talk with these people and help them through issues. Well, the problem was, once we got through, we all kind of patted ourselves on the back and said, you know, we did a great thing today. We said, but what about the people that are going to need somebody next month? So we did it again, like, I don't know, 4 or 5 months later. And I thought, there's no continuity to this whatsoever. And so I got together. I had two great colleagues that worked with me, McKenna Cox and Matt Bolton, they're of the Washington County Bar Association. And we got together and we said, why don't we try to do this on a monthly basis? Mm-hmm. And so we started 5 years ago doing a free legal advice only. We don't take cases, but we will sit down with anybody, no matter what their station in life is, no matter what their color is or anything. Anybody's got a legal problem, we'll sit down and talk with them. And we started doing it at the Good Samaritan Ministries from 9 to 11, the first Saturday of each month. First started out, we probably had, you know, anywhere from 6 to 8 lawyers that would show up. And, and on the average, that's probably pretty much the, what, you know, what we have, 6 to 8 lawyers that will show up. And we, and now the clinic has been going for 5 years. We usually see somewhere between 30 to 60 people at a time. We have Hispanic interpreters that come and volunteer their time. We usually have 3 to 5 paralegals that come and volunteer their time.
Mm-hmm.
We have lawyers from corporations such as Eastman that come in, and I could never understand what was motivating them, but they would look at me and they'd say, well, you know, we do environmental work or we do patent work, but we really would like to do this kind of work. And so I get a couple of those that come every month.
Recapturing a little of that idealism that drove them to law school all those years ago.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And watching them grow and develop into this has been a lot of fun. So we did that for a while. And then we thought, well, you know, what are the other needs? And we, you know, the judges were just tickled to death with us and they liked what we were doing. And we went and canvassed them and we said, well, what else, what other needs do we have? Well, you know, in this day and age with the internet and with the do-it-yourselfers and with the, what I call the Walmart mentality, I need everything done today. You know, people are trying to do their own divorces. They're trying to do a lot of their own legal work. And so primarily, there's a lot of people filing divorces. So we got together with the judges, and the judges put all the, what we call pro se, that means represent yourself, all the pro se people representing themselves, divorces got all put on one day. And so then we will go down once a month and volunteer and help those people with their forms or present their case to the court. And we actually even have lawyer mediators that show up when they have contested cases that volunteer to help mediate the case.
Oh, I bet the judges love you too, not just the clients.
Well, it helps.
Because that's a challenge for a judge. People have a right to represent themselves as a general rule. And so a pro se client comes before a judge, and the judge can't just say, go get a lawyer. He doesn't want a lawyer. He can't afford a lawyer, whatever the reason. But then, with all due respect, pro se litigants, people there on their own, don't typically know how to do things. And so the judge has to struggle with sort of walking them through the process while still maintaining the judge's impartiality. And that's so hard for a judge. And it's hard for a judge to sit there and watch somebody screwing up his own case or watch somebody gunking up the court system, taking, you know, 3 hours to do something that a lawyer could do in 5 minutes. And so I bet the judges just love you when you show up on the divorce day.
Well, you know, as you and I both know, the legal rules, the evidentiary rules, and the procedural rules are very, very technical. We spent 3 years learning them, and we never stopped learning them after that. And when somebody comes in and says, hey, I printed off a sheet off the internet about this particular rule, and the judge is going, you don't understand all the intricacies of that. You're exactly right. That, to me, that's one of the most painful things to see as a lawyer sitting in the audience of a courtroom and watching some judge try to deal with that, try to look at somebody and say, I can't give you legal advice, but you can't do that, or you need to do this.
Right, exactly. And then 15 other people waiting to have their day in court,
right,
and they can't get up there because this poor fellow or this poor woman is up there trying his or her best, but just gunking up the works for everybody else. So it's an access to justice issue, not just for the people you're helping, but for everybody else that you're in the court system that day. So that's a really good idea, to put all those divorce cases, those pro se divorce cases, on the day. And so you have lawyers to present it, and you have also lawyer mediators who are there.
Correct.
That is just great.
Yeah. So that was our, you know, all of this evolved. Like I said, we first started with the 5 years ago with the free legal advice clinic on Saturdays once a month. So then it evolved into this doing this pro se thing. Well, then we canvassed the judges again, and the general sessions court judges, these are the ones, again, that are the small claims. Anytime you have a civil claim under $25,000 in Tennessee, it goes to small claims. Orders of protection, all of those types of small claims where people are trying to evict people out of apartments or repossess cars or do credit card collections and things like that. They were screaming, said, you know, this is where the rubber meets the road. It's down here in the small claims court, and people are getting their brains messed over because they don't have representation. You would have all these corporations that would send in these big creditor lawyers, and they were filing things that they shouldn't have been filing, and they were basically abusing people. So we've
heard a lot about that recently in the housing crisis.
Correct.
Because you had all these mortgages that nobody even knew who owned them anymore. And then these places where they had the robo-signers who were signing off on documents they shouldn't have. And then these lawyers for the mortgage companies are going in and presenting them to the judges as if everything's in order. And it turns out they're not in order, but the people who were holding the people who had to pay on the mortgages didn't know how to contest this.
Right.
And so you just had them steamrolled in court by these mortgage companies. And that's very, very well documented. That happened in thousands and thousands of cases. And so you're saying this also happens in a lot of other circumstances with creditors.
Well, exactly the same thing happens when, you know, say for instance, a credit card company decides that they can't collect a $5,000 debt. They will sell that debt to a collection agency, and the collection agency will try to present that, you know, on top of their attorney's fees and all types of court costs and things like that. And in Tennessee, it's very, very difficult for them to prove an original debt once it's been sold.
Mm-hmm.
But most people don't know that, and if they don't have some help.
It is so funny you should mention that, Tony, because back in the day when I was doing what you do, or something similar, I had my own practice down in Florida. From time to time, somebody from my church or somebody from I just happen to know would say, these debt collectors are hounding me about this debt. And of course, I'd say, well, you know, do you owe it? You know, have you tried to pay on it? And sometimes they would say, no, I don't even know what this is. And oftentimes, all I had to do was call up the debt collector and say, hi, you know, I'm representing so-and-so. You say he owes $500. Okay, well, send me the documentation. You know, show me where he signed something
right,
that says he owes you $500. And if he owes you $500, he'll pay you $500. And almost always, there was nothing.
Right.
You know, they'd send me documents that didn't prove the debt at all. And so a lawyer knows that. A lawyer knows that if someone wants to make you pay a debt, they have to be able to prove that you owe that money. And a lawyer knows the questions to ask. But if nobody knows that, then these people sometimes end up paying on debts that they never incurred.
Regularly. Daily that happens.
Uh-huh. And that's just terrible.
It is terrible. But we've kind of stopped a lot of it in Washington County, because what we do is we call the courthouse and we find out what is the heaviest collection day that you have. And those are the days that we go volunteer.
Okay.
And we represent everybody in the courtroom. The first time that I ever went, it was so funny. The first time I ever went, I stood up in the courtroom and I said, my name is Tony Seaton. I'm a volunteer lawyer here for the Washington County Bar Association. I'm here to help anybody with any problem that they have. I will represent everybody here if you want me to. Or I'll just answer your questions. I'm going to step outside here for just a minute, and then, you know, whoever wants to talk with me, you know, can do so. I cleared the whole courtroom. And the creditor lawyers, there were probably a half a dozen of them,
right.
And they have these big long faces, and they're looking right. at me like, oh, you SOB, what are we going to do with you? And so ends
people,
up...
People have to know their rights, and they don't know their rights. That's why lawyers go to law school, is to learn right. these things. I once had a person come to me at 3 o'clock in the afternoon and had an eviction notice. And the eviction was for the following morning at 8 o'clock. And I remember looking at that person thinking, what do you want me to do? I mean, you know, what am I supposed to do? But it was this elderly man, and the story he told made him look very much like a victim. Now, I had to take on faith that what he was telling me was true, because there was no time
sure.
for me to check anything out. So I called up the courthouse. I asked if I could see the judge on an emergency basis. Fortunately, the judge hadn't left for the day. Fortunately, I got in to see him. I went down there. I said, Judge, this is the story I've got. The moving vans are showing up at 8 o'clock tomorrow morning. I just need a little bit of time to sort this out. And literally, I was able to get an order for that judge. The judge signed an order that the guy was able to hand to the guys who showed up the next morning at 8 o'clock and stop them from evicting him. And ultimately, we were able to stop the eviction. But that's the kind, they didn't know the questions to ask, they didn't know what they were supposed to do, and they were on the verge of losing their homes. That was one of the most rewarding days in my entire legal practice, was saving those people's home. And of course, I didn't get a dime for it.
Right, right.
Of course, that's just the way it is.
Yeah, you point out two things. One is the gratitude that you get from helping people in the law practice, and the secondly is the typical day of a law practice.
It is often the typical day. As my wife said, she said, and I imagine we got paid a lot of money for this. She was my law partner as well, and I said, yeah, we got our usual fee. And she said, oh, you mean we earned some stars in our crown?
That's exactly right. Sure, absolutely.
All right, well, I didn't mean to start talking about all the wonderful things I did when I was a lawyer, but you're just bringing back things I hadn't thought about for years and years. Mm-hmm. And that's extremely gratifying. Well, you've identified a couple of different things you do. It's one thing to go into court and just, you know, one after the other represent people there, and it's pretty much, you know, you go do your thing and then it's over with. But when you talk about the legal clinics where people come in with problems, I'm guessing you can't dispose of all of those problems completely at that clinic all the time. I mean, some things you might be able to resolve with a bit of advice or filling out a form or something. But there got to be a lot of people who come into those clinics who have problems where you can only just say, look, you know, I can point you in a certain direction, but you're going to need continuing representation. What happens then?
Yeah, you know, sometimes you just kind of get sucked in. You know, you listen to this hard story, and then you say, you know what, I can't let you go out if you'll just follow me to my office or call me, you know, next week. And that happens a lot. But, you know, for the most...
So you're not just volunteering your time at this clinic. You're going to this clinic, and then you're getting on the hook for volunteering dozens, hundreds of more hours of your time down the road because you're not going to get paid.
You can.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. That can happen. But, you know, the thing about the legal clinic is, you know, you look at folks who need a lawyer and can afford a lawyer, and you say, you need to go hire a lawyer.
Right.
You know, and let me tell you what it's going to cost, and you can afford to do this, and if you need to go mortgage your house or whatever, you need to go hire a lawyer. You know, a lot of times we were criticized when we first started putting this together that we were taking business away from lawyers. No, we're not. We're doing the service that people couldn't hire a lawyer for a lot of times, but if they're, you know, if they can, we tell them, you know, absolutely go hire a lawyer.
Mm-hmm.
So then the second thing, you know, that we do in clinics is a lot of times 60%, my daughter is in law school, mm-hmm. and she came to me, or she came with me to the clinic after her first year and, you know, didn't understand a lot about practices and stuff like that. So she sits with me as I, you know, talk with some of these folks. And, you know, at the end of the day, she said, you know what? You're not doing much lawyer work. You're a counselor. And I said, that's what we are first. We're a counselor. We try to resolve people's issues. We try to listen to them, be empathetic, as we said earlier. And then if we can't, then and we identify a legal issue, then we try to help them with that. So if we can't get someone through it with free legal advice, you know, we do have kind of a network, and we do try to, you know, if somebody clearly qualifies for legal aid, I usually have somebody from legal aid that's there, and we can transfer them there. But if they don't, you know, we usually try to figure out some sort of solution for them.
It's kind of like a dentist. If you're at one of these remote area medical clinics, sometimes you can just fill somebody's cavity and send them on their way, and that's great. And sometimes you have to look at them and say, man, you need dentures.
Yep.
Or you need, you know, surgery, and, you know, here's what the next step is. And then you just, it's a continuing problem.
Yeah, you know, I'm glad you brought that up, because, you know, it's like dentists, there's a lot of them. My personal dentist, he goes over, you know, goes across the ocean, and they do all these dental clinics. I mean, doctors do. I mean, doctors have Doctors Without Borders. Dentists do. There's Habitat with Humanity. A lot of times people have identified our legal clinics as the legal profession's ability to give back to society that way.
Well, that's why we went to law school. I mean, we went to law school because we wanted to be lawyers. We went to law school because we wanted to make a good living. There's nothing wrong with any of that. But I think almost all of my law students, at least part of them, some of them more than others, really are going there because they want to help people and they want to serve the interests of justice. And so I'm betting that some of those corporate lawyers who come and volunteer for you, or a lot of the lawyers who volunteer for you, this is the thing they look forward to more than anything else that month.
Oh, you know, the funny thing was, one of the vice presidents from a major corporation in the area called me and said, I want to have lunch with you. And he said, I want to talk about access to justice. And so we go have lunch, and he says, I think I'd kind of like to go to the General Sessions Clinic with you one day. And he came over, and we did the clinic together. And, of course, nobody knew he was general legal counsel and the vice president of the corporation. Didn't have to enter, you know, I mean, he was just there as an ordinary lawyer.
Right. Well, that just sounds wonderful.
It was.
It's your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking with Johnson City attorney Tony Seaton about access to justice in civil cases. After the break, we'll talk some more with Tony, and then we'll have another visitor. So stay tuned. You're listening to your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking with Tony Seaton, a lawyer from Johnson City, Tennessee. And he's telling me all about access to justice. What do we do when people who have serious legal problems, not criminal problems, but things like divorce or child custody, things of that sort, when they don't have enough money to hire lawyers to represent them? Before the break, Tony was telling me how he started up programs to help with this problem and how he's been surprised by how many lawyers have been so eager to volunteer for and how much the lawyers themselves get out of it. And that reminded me of a movie. It's one of my wife's and my favorite movies, and I don't recommend it to many people because it's a movie about condemnation. Can you think of a more boring subject? Okay, but hear me out. It's actually a movie out of Australia from the 1980s, and it's called Castle, or I think it's The Castle. And it refers to that old adage, a man's home is his castle. Mm-hmm. And it's the story of this quirky family in Australia that loves where they live, even though where they live is not in the nicest neighborhood, and it's directly next to an airport. So you've got these big jets flying over them all the time. Well, the airport decides it wants to expand, and so they get a condemnation notice one day, we're going to take your property. And the guy goes into court and pro se and tries to defend himself and loses and loses and loses. And finally, at a certain point, a very, very prominent advocate before the bar enters the case. And I'm just going to leave it there. I'm not going to say anything more about it or how the case. I'm going to say, if you want to see this kind of stuff dramatized, actually dramatized in a somewhat comedic way, get the old movie, The Castle, and you'll see exactly what Tony's talking about here. I'm going to do something unusual here. Wayne is here in the studio with us, and Wayne sometimes listens in on the interviews and sometimes he doesn't. And generally when he sticks around, it indicates that he's really interested in something. So I'm going to give Wayne an opportunity here. Do you have any questions for Tony that you want about this Access for Justice program or about how lawyers do this sort of thing? While you're thinking about that, I'm going to mention something you just mentioned. You mentioned Matt Bolton. Matt Bolton is one of the people who volunteers with you in this Access for Justice program.
Correct.
He is the same Matt Bolton who's one of my former students, isn't he?
That's correct.
And
right.
He's married to Donna Bolton, another
right.
one of my former
right.
students. And tell me how great Matt is and the great things he's doing.
He is great. You know, and he was the Bar Association president I think 5 years ago when we started the program.
Right.
And so he's been great at continuing. He does a lot of the circuit chancery stuff where they do the pro se days.
Right.
And then of course another one of your students is my associate Robert Bates.
Yes.
And he, you know, Robert regularly goes to clinic.
Oh, he does. Great. I'm glad to hear that.
Absolutely. You know, the interesting thing is, you know, one of the oldest lawyers in our bar association who has since retired, I would call him and I'd say, will you be able to come to clinic? I don't know if I've got enough people on Saturday. And he finally looked at me one day and he said, Tony, don't ever call me again. He said, I will call you if I can't come to clinic.
Wow.
So, you know, the great thing about clinics is they become very addictive. I mean, they became addictive with me, and even some of my corporate folks will say that. And so as a result of what our program that we put together in Upper East Tennessee evolved into, then Supreme Court calls me and says, hey, you know, we've got a statewide Access to Justice Commission, and they appointed me to the statewide Access to Justice Commission. So on the Access to Justice Commission, we all started getting together. As a matter of fact, I'm going to a retreat with them, with the Supreme Court and with the Access to Justice Commission on Thursday and Friday. And we started developing similar clinics to what we've done in Washington County. There's been other counties, you know, actually there were some that even predated us, Murfreesboro and some other places. But ours has really just, you know, kind of been a good model. And so as a result of that, we started the same type of clinic in Kingsport. We started the same type of clinic in Bristol. And then this past Saturday, we did the first rural clinic in Mountain City.
Mountain City, really? How did that go?
Well, it went good. We had more lawyers than we had clients. I mean, when you first start one up, there's not a lot. But, you know, having the resources from the Access to Justice Commission, we had a lady who studied what our real needs were. And, unbeknownst to us, we thought, you know, maybe we needed to help homeless folks. Homeless folks don't have legal issues.
Hmm.
If you think about it.
Yeah, they don't own any property. They
Correct.
Probably don't have any credit cards. They don't. Yeah, they're kind of under the legal system. They're sort of, you know,
And occasionally they do. But, you know, we do our clinic at Good Samaritan, which, you know, we're in touch with.
Well, they might have, I'm thinking of homeless people, they might have criminal issues.
Sure.
Or they might have mental health issues. I'm
Correct.
Guessing those would be the two big areas for most homeless people.
Right.
Okay.
So in her study, she was doing a master thesis, and she said, you know, basically came up with the concept that we are representing the working poor. That was the biggest need, is mm-hmm. that of the working poor. Then the second major conclusion that she came to is most of our population in Tennessee is very rural,
mm-hmm.
very rural. Probably, I don't remember what the percentage was, but even of those, there's a huge percentage of those people who have transportation issues.
So what? They can't even get to the courthouse.
Correct. So what good does it do me to do a legal clinic in Johnson City? Although we did have people driving from Mountain City, what good would it do me if people couldn't get to us, you know, once a month? And so we came up with the idea of let's start a rural legal clinic. Went up there, found the circuit court clerk, Carolyn Hawkins, who's just was wonderful. Found one of the judges. We sat down and had a lunch, and they said, okay, yeah, we can do this. We'll do it Saturday from, 10 to 2, the second Saturday of each month. So our whole plan, or part of my plan as an Access to Justice Commissioner, is to do what I can to start these in every county that I can.
That's just marvelous. Well, Wayne, I've given you a chance to think. Yeah. Do you have anything you want to jump in here with?
Yeah, I was interested when you were talking about people who are being harassed by collection agencies and they don't realize that the agency has essentially bought that debt from the creditor and is required to demonstrate that that debt was actually incurred. And I was wondering, what sort of issues are people bothered by the most because of ignorance of the law? Where does ignorance of the law harm the most people?
And that's a great question, because the biggest thing that I see when I go to the General Sessions Court and somebody is being sued, they don't know what the repercussions of being sued means. Does that mean I'm going to jail? Does that mean you're going to throw me out of my house? Does that mean you're going to seize my car? You know, they have no idea what that means. And of course, being sued is only really the start of something. You know, if somebody sues me for $1,000, they take a judgment that day, and then they have to wait through the appeals process before they can collect anything. People don't understand that. They think, if I don't respond here, I'm scared to death. Am I going to go to jail?
Well, what about substantive areas of law? Now, that's obviously just ignorance of the litigation process, but is there some substantive area other than debt collections where people's ignorance is really harming them more than the average?
Well, you know, especially in the collection area, yes, because if they don't understand what it takes to prove a debt, then they, you know, most of the time they'll walk in and say, I realize I owe it, and you know, maybe an unscrupulous creditor will say, well, okay, not only do you owe the $2,000 that you put on the credit card, but you've also, here's another, you know, $700 of attorney's fees, here's such and such cost, here's interest of 15% per month, you know, for the past 5 years kind of thing. And so, yeah, absolutely, there's a lot of substantive issues too.
Yeah, and beyond that, I mean, I had said before that, you know, if a person owes a debt, the person's going to pay a debt. Well, sometimes a person can't pay a debt.
Right.
I mean, sometimes a person incurred a debt, but then it's the circumstances are now they simply don't have the money. If they have a lawyer who's there to represent them, the lawyer knows that there's room for negotiation. And the lawyer's going to prevent the other side from simply tacking on a bunch of other things that make the debt even more unpayable. There's more than one occasion I recall when I would do that on behalf of a client. I'd basically say, yeah, you know, you're right. You know, there's a $1,000 debt here, and this guy has no money. Mm-hmm. And so let's figure out what we can do to satisfy you, but also make it possible for him to get out from under this. And we go through that negotiation. And then ultimately, you know, nobody's completely happy with that.
Right.
But you work out a deal, and sometimes people can't do that on their own.
Well, and sometimes the creditor lawyers, I don't mean to be beaten up on creditor lawyers, because a lot of them are very compassionate. You know,
that'd be a tough racket to be in.
True.
It really would be. So here's a shout out to the collection lawyers. You guys have got a tough job too, and it's a legitimate job as well, and as long as you do it ethically, right?
Exactly. And,
right.
And you know,
like any lawyer, yeah.
Sure. And a lot of times these people that are getting sued, you know, they'll realize that they owe the money, but you know, what if the woman has $800 a month Social Security check? She has no other assets, she has no income, she's retired, etc. They can't touch that Social Security check. And so a lot of times, you know, once you can sit them down and point that out to the lawyers or to whomever, a lot of times those debts will go away.
Right, they'll just realize they have to write them off.
Right.
Okay, well, before we end, I want to ask, what's your favorite story? What's your favorite war story from what you've done at one of these clinics or what you've done with Access to Justice? What gave you the biggest warm fuzzy?
Probably just walking into the General Sessions Court. You know, the first time, as I explained, and I cleared the courtroom, and then I went back the next time.
That would be hard to top.
It is hard to top, you know, and I go back in the next time, you know, a month later, and almost every time I would clear the courtroom. But when you have the little old lady who's saying, I can't pay this, I'm on my Social Security check, I didn't know what was going to happen to me today, I am so glad you're here. Thank you so much. I don't think you get any more out of life than that.
No, that's when you go home and kiss your wife and thank your lucky stars that you've got the ability to help people that
way.
Well,
and, you know, one of the things they had asked me for a quote in the Tennessee Bar Journal the other day about the practice of law and why we do clinics. And I said, you know, the practice of law is a gift.
It is. We're very privileged to be able to do it, Tony. We are.
And you can either squander it or you can share it.
Well, I'm reminded of Peter Parker's gentle Uncle Ben. With great power comes great responsibility, whether you're a lawyer or whether you're Spider-Man.
That's right.
Wasn't that a great interview with Tony Seaton? He is a great guy, and he's got a great program, and I was very pleased to highlight it in this show. Now let's change our focus a little bit and talk to another buddy of mine. His name is Jeffrey Morrison, and he runs something called the James Madison Foundation.
Well, Stuart, first of all, thanks again for having me back on the show. I'm delighted to do it with you. I am Associate Professor of Government at Regent University, and then I am Academic Director of the James Madison Foundation, an independent federal agency in Alexandria, Virginia.
And what does this independent federal agency with this intriguing name do?
Well, the name is actually more intriguing. The full name is the James Madison Memorial Fellowship Foundation.
Cool.
It's commonly known as the James Madison Foundation. And it was created by Congress to commemorate the bicentennial of the Constitution in 1987,
mm-hmm.
but to do so in a way that was permanent and that had a permanent legacy to honor our namesake, James Madison, but more importantly, to teach about the Constitution. So the foundation is about educating educators, principally secondary school teachers. We do have some middle school teachers as well, but principally secondary school teachers who are among the best high school teachers in their individual states. And we help them with a fellowship, a $24,000 fellowship, to aid them in their own graduate programs in history and political science. And we bring them to Washington, D.C. for an intensive month-long 6-credit-hour seminar on the foundations of American constitutionalism, which we hold at Georgetown University.
So you not only give them this 6-credit month-long seminar, which I'm sure is just wonderful, but you also give them $24,000 to apply toward, I'm guessing, some sort of master's degree?
That's right. They are, most of them are currently graduate students. A few of them are just entering their programs.
Mm-hmm.
But principally in history and political science, we occasionally will have some education graduate students as well. But principally those two disciplines. And you used the word give, and it is a gift of sorts, but it's a gift that has strings attached to it.
Mm-hmm.
Once they finish their master's program, they do have a commitment to teach either in the public school system or in private schools, but at that level, either the high school or middle school levels. And we like them to be sort of AP government teachers or civics teachers, something that has to do with the Constitution.
Mm-hmm. How long is the commitment?
The commitment varies. We have a calculus that is individualized. So it depends in part on the fellow's circumstances as well. But it generally is a several-year commitment.
Oh, okay. Well, so you want serious teachers who are going to come and who are going to learn and who are going to get these graduate degrees and then who are going to go back and share that knowledge at whatever grade level they started at.
That's very well put, Stuart. And they're serious to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
It's a rather rigorous application packet, as you might imagine, for that kind of fellowship payout. But these are dedicated folks. Generally, they are long-term teachers, most of them lifelong teachers, career teachers, who are, as I said, among the best in their states. And generally, we will bring one per state to Georgetown each summer. Occasionally, we will have, say, a couple of fellows from the larger states, the more populous states, Texas, California, and so forth. But that is what we do, at least in the summer.
Mm-hmm. And so there are roughly 50 or 60 students in your program at any given time?
Exactly. Mm-hmm. That number varies by a small margin, but generally in that 50, 55 to 60 number each summer, correct?
Well, that just sounds like a wonderful program. Now, I'm sure there are secondary and middle school teachers listening right now who have already started counting that $24,000. How do they go about getting their hot little hands on it?
Stuart, you're a terrific interviewer. You're anticipating all the things I wanted to say. Well, the easiest way is to go to our website, www.jamesmadison.gov, and it's very easy to navigate into the application portion of the website. And, you can just take it from there.
You heard the man, all you high school and middle school history and government teachers. Get online, find the Madison Foundation, the James Madison Foundation, and apply for that grant. That's a lot of money, and it's a great program. In fact, I'm going to be on the selection committee this year, so make sure you mention the radio show. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. Our distribution engineers are Nick Rosa and Bob Hoffman. Our scheduler is Carol Hutchinson. Our theme music is by the Watauga Fife and Drum Corps. My name is Stuart Harris, and remember, you are a part of the American experiment.